hold on tight for the next hour. You're entering into a place, a zone called the alternative to the alternative media. It's a place, a special place, where even truth seekers fear to tread.
All right, people, let's move like you've got a purpose.
Affirmative.
Okay, we're back on the Greg Anthony Show on this Tuesday. It's January 4th, 2022 on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Hey, listen, I promised you guys this year we'd stay away from that five-letter word. You know what? Why not? Because it's all a hoax. But anyway, we're going to get back to history, hidden history. I've done a poor job of it in the past, and I promise this year that I would do a better job. And boy, are we in for a ride. So fasten those seatbelts. And I'm telling you something, you're going to hear things that, boy, will shock you. But you know, that's the way you get through that door of truth. There's only one way. It hurts sometimes. It pains you sometimes. But it's better than being led by the nose like all those sheeple out there. Do you want to be just like them? No. And you know, the sad thing is many people don't even realize it. And that's what we're going to try to uncover here. So basically, what is lost history? What is it? Is it what Napoleon really said? He said that history really is nothing but a compilation of agreed upon lies. And I think as we look at what's happened since 2020, we realized that, boy, it never ends. Every year we learn a little bit more about the lies that the rulers of evil have put upon us. So, let me tell you how this all started for me to improve upon me giving you something to think about. Because for years and years, I delved into the past, spent a lot of time looking at things, how the United States was really formed for that secret purpose, the lies told by the Vatican throughout history, and some of the more important dates we've discussed. And I reached a point when this hoax hit and everybody's now transfixed in what I call a Jesuit curse, they have you under some kind of spell. I started to really, after months and months and months of making light of it in a sense to keep my sanity, I reached a point where I was going to quit this show. I said, there's nothing more I could, I'm not going to get into this anymore. There's nothing I can say that will change, because now if you speak about the Vatican, people aren't going to go, what's that? Is that a new virus? So I started to say, you know, there's no sense in this. I'm going to go off on my merry way, do some fishing, enjoy my life as it unfolds, and forget about these rulers of evil. Then, of course, a guy that I've known for 20 years ruined all that. Yes. And I'll give you his name. His name is Brian David Anderson. I've had him on my show many times. Go look at his website. It's Trivortex. He does a lot of interesting things. And Brian, over the years, for maybe the last 20 years, I always jokingly call upon him when I think I've exhausted every aspect of everything I was discussing. For example, the Kennedy assassination. So I call on Brian. He gives me another angle. Well, I guess he must have somehow realized I was thinking this way of quitting, and I got an email from him out of nowhere. This was before the holidays. And he said, Greg, have you seen this man's videos? It's incredible what he has seen. And boy, I said, okay, it's Brian again. So I didn't have anything to do one night, and I started to listen. And one of them was 5 hours long, and I very rarely can get through 20 minutes. I went straight 5 hours with this guy. And after I started thinking about it, I went away with this idea of, how stupid are you, Greg? You've been talking about all these signs and symbols which tell us what the New World Order or the Vatican and the Jesuits and everybody are doing to us. And, for example, the obelisks, all the occult symbols on buildings throughout the world, old and new. And I would look at those and say, you know, let's have a, I'm going to start a company, and what we're going to do is create occult tours where I take you and show you all of these symbols, which show you really what these people are up to. Well, anyway, I'm listening to this man, and what I'm going to play for you today is going to wake you up, because I didn't really look at the buildings. I assumed that what I was told was true about them. I'm talking about all of these old cathedrals, all of these old structures in Paris, Moscow, even the United States, Europe, all over the place, Asia, you name it. And I assumed what I was told about how they were built during the 19th century was true. But man, when this guy brought this information up, it led me on a, I said, boy, I've got to stay in this. I've got to bring this stuff to the people. I've got to keep talking about it. And hopefully we can really understand, because it all goes back to the ancient world. How were we created? What really happened? What's this earth really like? Do we really know? I mean, we're going right back to this theory of what are we standing on? What is above us? And how were, you know, what was going on during the ancient world? What was their knowledge? You know, the Vatican's going to say it was aliens, but was it? No, I don't think so, but we're not going to discount it. But where did they come from? Even if it was, we don't know anything. We rely on what we are told. And when you see, for example, start with 2022, you're going to be being told a whole bunch of lies today about what's captivating the world, this hoax. Before that, you're told a whole bunch of lies about 9/11. Okay, and it goes on and on and on. From that lie spews more. And then if you go back to the Kennedy assassination, go back to the founding of America, go back to wherever Napoleon said, and you know, he was right, history really is a compilation of agreed upon lies. So what we're going to try to do is go back and figure out, at least present theories about what this world is really like, what it was like back in the ancient world, what it was like when we started to repopulate, and now, what are they trying to do? Depopulate. The Great Reset is really one in a number of great resets. So, we're going to start exploring it. And today, what I want to do is, like I said before, this is not an easy task. I tried to give you hidden history for 20 years, and I did a terrible job. You know, I look back at some of the things I did. Oh, we uncovered a few things here and there. But boy, it still left me a bit uneasy, a bit hollow. You know, every time, for example, let me give you the way this works sometimes. First of all, I believed in the heliocentric theory, right? Believed in it full. You know, I was told that since I was a kid. Then I started to wonder, did we really go to the moon? And I did a whole bunch of things on that and finally came to the conclusion it was impossible, but it was still in a heliocentric structure. But as time went on, I started to think, how could that be? And so the ideas flow from one thing to another. So when we go back to the ancient world, let me start there, because that's where we'll start. But we're going to have to fast forward to the 19th century. Like I said, it's not easy. You can't just go back from 5,000 and work your way forward. You got to jump back and forth. And that's what we're going to do for the next year. But let me just start out with this quote. And a gentleman was reading regarding the fallen angels. Okay? And he said that, you know, the Bible and biblical records, it was sent to me, tell of how these enormous trees and other life came about. The fallen angels came down and began to genetically manipulate everything on Earth, maybe. Even the plants, trees, animals, and humans. There were giants in the Earth. Everything and all technology we have today is really old, and the ancient still had more. And we still haven't caught up at all to what they've done. And that was pre-flood world. The pre-flood world. The so-called star forts, the star cities, the enormous houses, the castles, the the enormous buildings remaining today, are they just remnants of the pre-flood world and the pre-flood technology? This is also the result of what people now are calling the mud flood, which is also why you can see the same style of building, pyramids, castles, etc., on every continent around the world. The Bible tells you, and even archaeological records that have been hidden, tells you this. And is this what the elites are trying to achieve again today, trying to hide this from you, the information that they have? Greatly reduce the population, unite the world as one race, one culture, one religion, and one language for the ultimate control, exactly the way it was pre-flood. Okay, so that's a mouthful. And you would think I'm going to go back and start with that era, looking at what the Bible said about that, looking at archaeological records, looking at many different things, books that have been hidden from you for years, go back to that period and work our way up. Even I mentioned yesterday, remember the Russell Crowe adaptation of Noah, the story of Noah, and in that you'll see the giants, the enormous 6-mile-high trees that were they cut down? Who did it? And most people will look at that as a Disney feature, a sci-fi, of what really went on. But was it true? We don't know. Everything really is just a guess. So where are we going to start? We're going to go back there? No. We're going to go with the gentleman that I listened to for 5 hours straight. And there's many more, and I'll tell you who he is at the end. Or at least how you can find all of his work, because you really have to go over it a number of times. I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg here, because we got a lot to cover this year. But we're going to start with what made me feel so stupid. Like I said, for years, spent a majority of years checking out all these occult symbols on these buildings without ever looking and asking the simple question, how could they have been built with 19th century technology? Where did they come from? Well, this man put the dots together like nobody I've seen. And we're going to start there because it opens the door, like I said, to the ancient world, to what it was like, their technology. And you may be surprised. I'm not telling you to believe it. I'm telling you to put it in your arsenal of theories, of knowledge. Because really, in the going on what we believe, you know, are you tired of listening and believing these people that are lying to you worldwide? And take, for example, what I just said. History is a compilation, like Napoleon said, of agreed-upon lies. So really, it's guesswork. So why not add some information that maybe you haven't heard about? And if you've heard about it, maybe it's good to listen again. So what we're going to do is listen to this gentleman start in the 19th century, right around the time when photographs were first being used. The camera was just developed. We're going into a society that was horse and buggy, shovels, no big equipment. The power tools weren't even invented. How could these buildings have been built? Gives us a clue to what the ancient world maybe was like. And this guy does a hell of a job. Okay, here we go.
Our journey begins in the unlikeliest of places. 19th century St. Petersburg, at the entrance to St. Isaac's Cathedral. The city cold, the early morning mists dissipating with the approach of the sun. and our boots caked in mud. The year is 1860, and while St. Petersburg stands regal and proud, its inhabitants are nowhere to be found. It is quiet, too quiet. The population of St. Petersburg in the 1860s was, we are told, roughly 500,000 people, and yet there is not a soul in sight. Where is everybody? The long shadow of Alexander Column gives us a clue as to the time of the sun's journey above this region. Long shadows only occur during morning or evening. It must be morning, but it appears that no one has surfaced yet. If we travel 400 miles across to Moscow, we see the same thing. Empty, quiet streets. In 1860, Moscow shared a similar population with St. Petersburg, roughly 500,000 citizens. But again, where is everybody? What about the rest of the world during this time period? Edinburgh, Scotland, 1840s.
A lot of empty buildings.
Copenhagen, Denmark, 1840s. Dresden, Germany, 1860s. Rio in Brazil, 1860s. Toronto, Canada, 1860s. Athens in Greece, 1860s. And then London, finally, people. And what about Paris? People, life. The first photograph, we are told, was created in 1822. The art of photography relies on methods of juxtaposition, of comparison and contrast to deliver its message and sentiment. In these old photographs, we do not find the same deliberate techniques of juxtaposition that contemporary photographers craft into their art. But rather, we find natural contrasts that are so important and central to navigating through our deceptive history. Contrast is a phenomenon, natural or artificial, in which meaning is generated and conveyed through the comparison of two opposing elements. When looking at 1860s Russia, there is an immediate contrast between the lack of population and the sheer size of these cities. Even in the 19th century, both Moscow and St. Petersburg are enormous. The infrastructure found in the photographs could hold a population well into the millions. Why are the cities so vast if the population was only 500,000 in each? Furthermore, the official narrative gives us a population that increases in a linear fashion from 1764. Many of the buildings we see here were built years before the photograph was taken. Did the Russians just plan well in advance? But it's when the population is introduced into these photographs that a new contrast emerges that is staggering. That is, between the people and the environment itself. It may be the reduced population numbers, or it may be the monochromatic starkness of the black and white images, but they present to us something that we've lived amongst our entire lives and never paid any mind to. That is, the enormity and impossibility of the architecture. As we engage with the industry and acts of tourism, we journey from place to place and observe, taking it all in, learning, hearing, and being told what we are looking at and how it came to be. And standing in front of a structure like the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, we might even exclaim, "Wow, how did they do this?" But the moment, inextricably wrapped up in the busyness of the scene, perhaps prevents us from really asking that question with sincerity. Standing in front of a structure like the Arc de Triomphe, while the crowd frantically takes pictures on their smartphones, makes it all a reality. And we conclude, before being shoved away by new tourists, "Well, they had to have done it somehow, because I'm here and looking at it." During our indoctrination at school, we are seldom shown old photographs of the grand cities scattered around our flat realm. And perhaps for good reason. Because when we marinate on images like this, and are presented with the visual evidence of a very primitive Victorian people, dotted around like grasshoppers within the shadows of the most magnificent, grandiose, brilliant architecture a human could ever imagine, we begin to have doubts. Indeed, how did they build this? The Arc de Triomphe is made from 36,695 cubic meters of limestone and weighs 95,407 tons, or just over 95 million kilograms. They tell us it took 12 years to build the giant arch in two different periods, between 1806 to 1814, and between 1832 to 1836. How did they transport this amount of limestone with the same horse and carts that we see in the photographs? Look closer at the four sculptures that adorn each of its sides. Look at the intricacy of the sculptures and the patterning of the ornamentation that frames the arch. Each section is perfectly repeated without any deviation or inconsistency. The first true power tool was not invented until 60 years after this arch was completed. They tell us this was crafted by hand. Is that even possible? And then there is the ceiling of the arch. Immaculate, 3D sculpted roses, perfect in their geometric symmetry. The nuance of the detail and finesse of each petal and cross-section borders is overwhelming. Look at the rest of Paris during this time. Again, a plethora of unbelievable, gigantic, and magnificent structures. The city's infrastructure, glorious, and the people and their means of transport, primitive, unsophisticated, and seeming not at all developed to the point of producing a city like this. The roads are improperly paved and uneven. They are dirty and muddy. We also see buildings during this period in which the architecture aligns with the inhabitants. Buildings of misshapen proportions, less developed and refined, charming in their own way, but coarse in their use of wood and plaster. This is exactly the type of architecture we expect of a generation of horse and cart.
Okay, what we're going to do is take a break, but did you get that? I mean, did you really listen to that? How many times have you been to Paris and never thought of that? Amazing. That's why I felt so stupid. But now, you know, we're opening another door that'll help us understand what the ancient world and what our Earth is really like. Back in 3 minutes on the Greg Anthony Show here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
Visit CrossTheBorder.org, C-R-O-S-S, CrossTheBorder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's book titled When the Third Temple is Built. That's CrossTheBorder.org. When it comes to prophecy today, much of the evangelical Christian world has their eyes on Israel, waiting and watching to see when the Third Temple will begin to be built. The plans are drawn, the Jewish people are eager, Most evangelical Christians today believe that the rapture will happen before the third temple is built. Hi, I'm Michael Eugene. I was taught that Daniel's 70th week was in the future. Is that really what the Bible teaches? Have we searched the scriptures and found this to be true? Why is it so important for a re-established Israel to build a third temple in Jerusalem? Is it necessary to build a temple on the same location already occupied by the Dome of the Rock? Is it necessary for sacrifices to take place in the temple on Temple Mount? Is there really a rapture followed by 7 years of tribulation? What is the New Testament temple? Can we identify history and prophecy? Who is the first beast in Revelation chapter 13? Who are the seven kings in Revelation 17? I have asked all these questions, and I have found Nicholas Arthur's new book, When the Third Temple is Built, answers all these questions and more using Scripture to interpret Scripture. The Bible says that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. Nicholas shows us in his book, When the Third Temple is Built, how the Bible interprets prophecy and not man's private interpretation. Visit CrossTheBorder.org, C-R-O-S-S, CrossTheBorder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled, When the Third Temple is Built. That's CrossTheBorder.org.
The following program is labeled dangerous and off-limits by the Supreme Jesuit Command, but stand tall, people. Listen up, and you may just learn something.
Oh, dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Greg Anthony Show here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. On this January 4th, 2022, we're taking a trip back in history. In the 19th century, trying to figure out how they built all those beautiful buildings when they were riding around in horse and buggies and the roads were completely muddy, and you'd think they'd have really nice freeways if they had all these great buildings like the Arc de Triomphe in France, many of the great cathedrals. But maybe, just maybe, this gives us a clue to what the ancient world was about, so we can really understand what's going on today and why the rulers of evil are putting humanity through the grinder right now, some saying wanting to change our DNA. Well, let's go back and discuss what was going on back in the 19th century, right around the time the camera was invented and even before the first power tool.
We also see buildings during this period in which the architecture aligns with the inhabitants. Buildings of misshapen proportions, less developed and refined, charming in their own way, but coarse in their use of wood and plaster. This is exactly the type of architecture we expect of a generation of horse and cart, a generation ignorant to the discoveries in technology that would follow in the years to come. Furthermore, at the time of this photograph, the arch is roughly 40 years old since its completion. Yet can you see how worn some of the parts of the structure are? We see weathering on the stone that suggests the arch is much older. As we approach the late 19th century, we see that the people of Moscow have finally decided to leave their homes and venture out into the streets. The infamous Red Square, now bustling with life. St. Basil's Cathedral and the Spasskaya Tower dominate the frame of the square. The construction of St. Basil's Cathedral began in 1555 and was completed in 1561, a mere 6 years. It suffered a huge fire in 1737 and underwent restoration over a 20-year period. But look at it. What a structure. Almost unreal and like no other. It is composed of thousands of red bricks and tin sheet metal that has been shaped into the distinctive onion domes we see. Look closer at the intricacy of the domes. How did they bend metal to achieve such precision and perfection in the 18th century? And again, if they had the skills and dedication to build a wonder such as this, then why are the conditions of the road so poor and covered in mud? We see these incredible structures and buildings everywhere in 19th century photography. We have the wondrous Crystal Palace of London, a monstrous structure with the greatest area of glass ever seen in a building, and all constructed before England had automatic glass manufacturing. We have Westminster Abbey and Parliament. We have the old Euston Arch, constructed out of pure sandstone in 1837, and streets unpaved and full of mud. Why did these people not prioritize the streets they walked upon? The Frauenkirche, the domed masterpiece of Dresden, Germany. Its intricate and opulent splendor in direct contrast with the beat-up wagons and horse-pulled carts of the people below. A people dependent on the bare necessities. A people completely dwarfed by its size and majesty. The Library of Parliament in Ottawa, Canada. Built over a period of 17 years. The first major settlers arrived in 1800, and at the time of construction, the city's population was under 20,000. Would a grand, glorious library really be a priority for settlers? Why does the building look like it's been cropped out of Europe and pasted into Canada? Even at the turn of the century, 40 years before Bosch economized the power tool, we have the old Penn Station in New York. Look at the size of this. Completely mind-blowing proportions. As we can see here in the photograph, each octagonal sculpted pattern on the arched dome ceiling is larger than one individual human. Look at the gigantic columns and detailed acanthus sleeves decorating the tops of each pillar. They tell us this station took 6 years to build. 6 whole years. Yeah, right. Why are we so gullible? Even without access to modern power tools, printable construction pieces, and crane technology, we could not reproduce this today. And more importantly, we don't reproduce this type of architecture today. The official liars of our world have an umbrella term for this type of architecture that we see in North America. They call it historism. Historism is a term coined to describe a style of architecture that is revival in nature, or in other words, copies the style of another period in time. The grand arches and buildings with giant columns we see are built in the classical or Greco-Roman style. And the cathedrals are built in the Renaissance and Gothic styles of medieval Europe. Components of these particular styles of architecture feature large spires, arched windows, towers, turrets, domes, arcaded arches, sculptures, enormous doors, circular geometric windows, columns, clock faces, and bell towers. Traces of this impossible architecture are literally found everywhere, in every city, and across our world today. Some preserved and maintained, like the Parisian Arc de Triomphe and Notre Dame, and others lost and long forgotten to time, like the Euston Arch and the old Penn Station in New York. We as a people travel miles to take our own photographs of these wonders. But the photographers of the 19th century gift us with something. Something they would never have expected to give a future generation. Perspective. We see a primitive people against a backdrop of clearly advanced architectural infrastructure. The official historians of the world tell us tales of Darwinian evolution and progression between time periods. The people that came after were always more advanced in their ways, refining and redefining the methods of the generation that came before. If the height of innovation and industry during the 19th century was still the horse and car as a means of travel, then, as these photographs tell us, this style of architecture was just as impossible for those living in the centuries before it. Anyone with a predisposition for thinking and questioning can immediately sense when looking at these photographs that something is rotten in Denmark, that something is off with the mainstream historical narrative, that something is not adding up. In a panoramic image of San Francisco in 1877, we see a collage of historicist architecture. We see columns adorning the entrances to very regal buildings that stand out like sore thumbs from some of the timber shacks surrounding it. We see Gothic spires and towers in the distance. We see domed cathedrals and buildings. We also see just how sprawling and huge the city has become. In 1846, there were under 500 Mormon settlers living on the area of land in which we now call San Francisco. It was frontier land and ready for the taking. Between 1848 and 1849, with the start of the California Gold Rush, the population increased from 1,000 people to 25,000 people. 28 years later, this panorama was taken. The population at this time, we are told, was getting close to 200,000. Who in their right mind would believe this story? Does this look like a city of 200,000 people? Without any modern technology, power tools, automatic manufacturing, electric motors. A people in a strange, unfounded land, just making their mark. Do we really believe that a burgeoning people built this entire city in just 30 years? And again, such quietness, such stillness. This is a photograph of an empty city. Where are all the people? The shadow of the post here tells us that it is not the early hours of the morning. Short shadows only appear toward midday. A city of this scale at noon should be bustling with life. But there is not a single person in the shot of this panorama. The only life we see is that of a horse without any master in sight. It seems highly unlikely that all the people were told to stay indoors because a cityscape photo shoot was taking place. And this silent scene becomes all the more eerie when we consider that there is intention behind the lens. Someone was there, standing at a vantage point and taking this photograph. But who? And for what? And what are the chances that in the 19th century, during similar decades, we see deserted Russian, European, and North American cities photographed like this? And then only a few years later, we find the same locations bustling with people. A people clearly incapable of building the architecture found in these cities. And what to do with these photographs? If we accept the narrative and these strange anomalies, then we stop here and get back to our busy lives. But the narrative we've received is not the truth. And we shouldn't accept any narrative, no matter how official and certified it is, unless it makes sense. The people we see in these photographs and their early ancestors could not have built the magnificent architecture we see. It is an impossibility. Come on, jump in. We must venture further into these cities and look a little closer. There must be some clues waiting to be uncovered that helps us understand why these cities are empty. Wait, what's that you say? You want to wipe the mud from your boots first? Do not bother. It's a waste of time. Come on, jump in and let's go. For it is the mud that offers us some small clues as to what could have occurred during this time period. In June 2011, Christchurch, New Zealand, suffered an earthquake that left a lot of the city in chaos, destroying buildings and infrastructure and leaving over 50,000 homes without power. As a result, there were collapsed houses, ruptured water mains, flooding, and fires due to disrupted electrical lines. Due to the strong ground motions and intense shaking, part of the city experienced a strange phenomenon known as soil liquefaction. Sand boils emerged from asphalt roads, toppling and sinking cars, and causing boulders to fall from hills, resulting in more home damage. Soil liquefaction occurs when saturated soil loses its strength and stiffness in response to an applied stress, such as shaking, or other sudden changes, such as a strong explosion. Loose, saturated soil or sand has a tendency to compress when a load is applied. But in the event of a stress, such as shaking or an explosion, we see the opposite. The soil tends to dilute, and the result is treacherous quicksand or quick clay. The land turns to liquid, causing structures of heavy mass, such as buildings, infrastructure, and cars, to start sinking, topple over, or collapse. It can also affect dams and bridges. Turbidity currents can also form huge landslides that are impossible to stop. In the worst case scenario, entire cities may be destroyed. As you can see, liquefaction can move entire areas of land. The mud can rise dramatically and rapidly, and its destructive force is unstoppable. It is a well-documented phenomenon. The 1964 earthquake in Niigata, Japan, caused liquefaction, and we can see the effects very clearly in these photos. The same here with the 1964 Alaska earthquake. Buildings toppling, cars sinking, infrastructure collapsing. Once the stress has subsided, the soil begins to solidify once again, and we can see the aftermath. Uneven, muddy streets remain where there was once road paving. Returning to photographs of 19th century cities, we see a similar situation here. The roads are unrefined and full of mud. We see unsophisticated, uneven, coarse, and muddy roads everywhere against a backdrop of refined, sophisticated, and magnificent architecture. Could these cities have suffered the similar fate of soil liquefaction that we see in more recent times? Perhaps. But unfortunately, muddy roads is not enough evidence to base any conclusions on, is it? Children ask the most vital of questions. And adults, in their foggy stupor, usually provide the most unsatisfactory answers. Often regurgitating learned nonsensical information that leave the child's imagination unfulfilled. Squelching along these muddy 19th century roads, observing their surroundings, a child may ask, why did they build the windows so low to the ground? And what an excellent question. Yes, why indeed did they build windows on ground level? For you see, the people we see in these photographs, sadly, did not build this architecture. And maybe some of them, at some point in their busy day-to-day life, ask the exact same question. We see it everywhere. Windows at ground level. Windows partially below ground level. First floor entrances raised from the ground level. Steps leading down to entrances below ground level. We can find this in almost every major city across our realm. In both old photographs and when we walk in the streets today. And what does it tell us? That a society with access to modest construction tools and horse and car constructed their infrastructure by first spending countless amounts of hours and energy clearing land with a depth of over 3 meters to begin their construction? Building basement floors is incredibly hard work. Since the 20th century, large powered excavation machines, such as backhoes, and front-end loaders have reduced the time and manpower needed to dig a basement dramatically as compared to digging by hand with a spade. Perhaps you could say that our historical ancestors were just that dedicated to the architecture they built,
And you could say that many of the sunken buildings we see are actually due to elevations and depressions in the natural landscape. The official narrative, which is always full of inconsistencies, perhaps would suffice if it was not for contemporary excavation. When we look at photographs such as this, it immediately dawns upon us that what we are seeing are windows and doors 2 to 3 meters below the ground surface. Why are there windows and doors underground? What is this that we see in our cities? Natural soil accumulation over time? Geologists have never been able to ascribe a consistent value to worldwide natural topsoil accumulation, because it is impossible. Some regions of our realm experience consistent topsoil accumulation, whereas other regions actually experience consistent erosion. Many historians and archaeologists have noted that many cities over the centuries have been destroyed through war, and natural phenomena such as earthquakes, volcanic ash, and flooding. Aren't these just the layers of previous civilizations? No, they are not. We see over and over again whole floors of buildings consistent with the architecture existing above the layer of ground. You see, what lies beneath is not the unfamiliar traces of previous generations, but of the same generation that built these structures. And once you really see this kind of sunken, buried infrastructure that exists in such prevalence across our world, you can never unsee it. We see that the foundations of old churches are actually the original first floors with consistent entrances and windows. We see mosaics unearthed. We see pillars, columns and arches that were originally much larger, and it was the layer of soil that reduced their size, as if they weren't big enough to begin with. And like with the 1964 earthquake in Niigata, Japan, we also find many so-called ancient structures that are leaning, as if at some point the soil beneath these structures loosened and liquefied. We have the Sehersen Church Tower and Our Dear Lady at the Mountain Church Tower in Germany, the Tiger Hill Pagoda in China, the Leaning Tower of Nevyansk in Russia, the Leaning Temple of Huma in India, Oudkerk in the Netherlands, the Tower of Zaragoza in Spain, and, of course, the Tower of Pisa.
Okay, Greg Anthony back, and we're going to stop there for now. That's a lot to swallow. And where are we going with all this? Greg, what's it so important that buildings are leaning, first floors are underground? What's so important about all this architecture? Well, people asked me that same question when I presented the obelisk. And people said, it's only an obelisk. It's not anything important. But why is it in front of your Capitol building, in front of the White House? Oh, we've talked about that, and it is important because it tells us where we are going. And to know where we're going, we have to understand the past, and the liars of the world have kept that from us. Back tomorrow, we'll get more into that on the Investigative Journal.
Somewhere, I know
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ."
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
American Family News, I'm Musty Peake. Members of the Virginia Department of Transportation provide...